Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
If we understand anything about the system of white supremacy, we know there is no way in the world that any black man, no matter how charming or intelligent he is, will ever have more power than the lowest status white man in a white supremacy system. And you know, they gave us some proof. The proof, in my opinion, was that racist white policemen who arrested and handcuffed black Harvard law professor, I mean, I don't know if he's a law professor, black Harvard professor Gates in his own home. And this white man, this civil servant, got an apology from the President of the United States, and he was rewarded with a trip, a free trip, and a photo op to the White House to have a beer with the President. Now, this civil servant was able to get the President of the United States to apologize, yet we think that a black man in a white supremacy system has power. To me, it seems that the white civil servant, that white male had more power, was had more status in that situation, because he never apologized, as far as I know, to the professor for arresting him. So look at the insults. Look at how the Obamas are talked about. And whether you like them or not, I guess it's beside the point. It's still proof that even despite his title and her title, they are still the target of tar baby jokes and pictures and Obama's an ape and talking about he's not a citizen, his birth certificate is invalid, you know, on and on, pictures of an ape shot full of holes with Obama's name above it. I mean, you know, all of this is a form of invalidation of people. It's saying to me basically that no matter what your title is, you still are not worthy of respect. The last thing I would say is false religions. I don't see what can be more dangerous psychologically than practicing the same religion and worshiping the same God that the slave owners taught us to worship. I can't think of anything more self-invalidating than that. They didn't teach us about the God that we had in Africa. Now, this is my own personal belief, and some people might disagree. But the God that we had in Africa, in my opinion, was the one who loved us, the one who wanted us to be free. They didn't teach us about a God like that. They taught us about a God that taught us it was normal and acceptable to be enslaved. They taught us to believe in white supremacy via a blind, blue-eyed Jesus. Taught us to turn the other cheek while they beat the hell out of us. Taught us to wait until we died to reach heaven and receive the riches that they were getting right now. And so you have to ask yourself, and this is what Malcolm X said, and this is, to me, I really love this quote. He said, so you call the same God he calls for. When he's putting a rope around your neck, you call for God, and he calls for God. And you wonder why the one you call on never answers you. So what color God did our African ancestors worship? How could God's son have been a white man in ancient Africa before the European even existed? How could black and white people really be worshiping the same God if that same God allows a European to have a wicked domain over the non-white planet? So, in my opinion, the true religion, based on everything I've seen of white people, is the religion of white supremacy. And we suspect this is true because everything else seems to be secondary to white supremacy. whether they are Christian, a Buddhism, is practice Buddhism, Islam, whether they're a Mormon, a Baptist, a Methodist, an Episcopalian, a Catholic, Judaism, whatever. It seems like no religion on earth is practiced by white people with the 364, 24/7-hour dedication that white supremacy is practiced. So if white supremacy is their true religion, how could a non-white person worship the same God that white people worship without that white non-white person supporting the practice of white supremacy? So it just seems that to follow the same religion that kept you enslaved, in some respects, is a form of self-invalidation, because something is wrong with the black community that has a church on every corner and hell in between.
Context of white supremacy. Pam the Great. Church on every corner, hell in between. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy, the religion of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, September 21, 2018. So I have been told. This is our fourth study session on Pamela Evans Harris, her second book, co-authored by she and her other writers, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. The audio segment that you heard, that from the summer of 2011, just a few months after this book was first published. I will step aside so that we can get right to the material. We are starting on chapter 23. Again, Pam the Great, she would want us to learn, study, and apply anything constructive that she left for us on these pages. Apply it as we go about the business of solving the problem. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, audio segment number one, context of white supremacy.
Chapter 23, The Color of Success. Miranda is a senior software programmer for a Fortune 500 company and earns a six-figure salary. She drives a luxury car, lives in a downtown condo just blocks from her job, eats out twice a day, and is always stylishly attired. 5'6" and attractive, Miranda maintains her trim 140-pound frame by exercising three times a week at the pricey health club in her apartment building. Miranda avoids interacting with any black copy clerks, messengers, and secretaries at her firm, since she has nothing in common with them. She has a handful of black friends and associates, all Ivy League grads like herself, who work for other Fortune 500 firms. She attends most company functions and occasionally joins her white coworkers for happy hour at the bars near their office. She dated a white consultant for a few weeks the previous year, but they went their separate ways after he said he wasn't looking for anything serious. She hasn't met anyone since and is dateless most weekend nights. Miranda has dated only a few black men over the last 15 years, but after one or two dates, they never called again, which led her to assume black women of her caliber intimidated black men. This was confirmed in her mind after one black jerk said at the end of their first and only date that if he wanted to date a white woman, he would find a real one. Miranda took that as a compliment. If Mr. Wright turned out to be white, she was okay with that. The truth is, Miranda feels more comfortable around whites, which is why she lives in a predominantly white area. She grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood and attended predominantly white schools where she had been one of a handful of blacks. She hadn't stayed in touch with her black classmates, and only occasionally wondered what had become of them. Although Miranda's Midwestern city is one of the most segregated cities in the nation, She swears she never personally experienced racism, except for the occasional white ignoramus who disliked blacks. Shoot, there were plenty of blacks she didn't like herself. She refuses to be manipulated by all that brother and sister crap blacks use as a crutch. All blacks had to do to overcome white misgivings and negative stereotypes was to be more prepared and work harder than their white peers. It was just that simple. Either a person was up to the challenge, and if they weren't, they had no one to blame but the person in the mirror. If they succeeded, the rewards were well worth it. Her impressive career was proof. More proof was the retirement party 3 weeks ago for the black vice president of public affairs. The company bigwigs went all out for McCabe. A rented hotel ballroom, a catered 5-course meal, a 6-piece jazz band, balloons, and champagne. Miranda had never seen anyone, let alone a black man, get such a royal send-off. It definitely beat a 30-year pin from the post office. When Miranda announced to a small group at the retirement party that she was a proud card-carrying Republican and had never once voted Democratic, she was secretly pleased by their surprised reactions. It was a prudent career move, she added, since the firm's biggest client was a staunch Republican. The truth was, Miranda despises being typecast as a black Democrat. She hated the patronizing way the Democrats threw out an occasional hem hock to get the black vote. Just what had Democrats done for black people like her lately? What was even more aggravating was the way the Republican Party ignored the thousands of blacks who thought the way she did. People who were educated, successful, intelligent, and understood the value of an unregulated free market, free trade, and minimal government regulation. Her lifestyle and stock portfolio was living proof of how well it worked. When the firm eliminated an entire division last year, mostly blue-collar jobs, Miranda saw nothing wrong with it. Every company had the right to find cheaper labor, even if that meant outsourcing jobs. Management had an obligation to maximize profits for the company and for stockholders like herself. Any workers who were displaced had to find new jobs. It was just that simple. On the day Miranda receives an outstanding job review, the firm announces plans to cut another 10,000 jobs to boost profitability. When the firm employs over 61,000 workers worldwide, Miranda isn't too worried, but assumed the people junior to her should be. Miranda is the only black person in her department, but that small detail hardly causes a wrinkle in her powder-smooth forehead. After chatting with a human resources manager, a black woman she was only marginally friendly with, Miranda discovers that she is the only one in her department with a master's degree. It feels good to know her job is secure, not that she ever doubted it for one second. Miranda feels appreciated at the firm, gets along well with her co-workers and boss, and always gets excellent performance reviews. She is confident that they see her as an equal and a valuable team member. The following Friday, pink slips are handed out in her department, and there is one with Miranda's name on it. Her entire department is being downsized, and the rumor is their jobs are being outsourced to India. No explanations or apologies were issued with the separation package that included 3 months' severance pay. Miranda packs her belongings in boxes under the watchful eyes of a security guard. She is furious, humiliated, and profoundly confused because she never saw the hammer coming. A few weeks after she was laid off, Miranda runs into one of her former co-workers, Beth, an accountant who still works for the firm. She tells Miranda that the programmers in Miranda's department had been transferred to other branches. Miranda is stunned. Why wasn't she offered a job when she had the most experience? And why didn't the sister in human resources warn her? The look of pity on Beth's face stops Miranda cold before the questions slip out. Then Beth says something that catches Miranda completely by surprise. She says Miranda should file an EEOC suit against the firm. Two of the senior Black accountants in Beth's area were laid off, while she and three of the least experienced accountants were shuffled into different jobs. Miranda didn't ask if the three were white. She didn't have to. Beth was. 8 months after losing her job, Miranda is still unemployed. The few job offers she receives pay a third of what she used to make. Miranda refuses to consider them, but is too proud to pound the pavement for a new job, even after her unemployment benefits run out. Eventually, the headhunters stop calling. A year later, Miranda is still unemployed, 35 pounds overweight, and is taking medication for depression. Her savings are exhausted, so she is forced to give up her condo and move back home to live with her bewildered parents. An epidemic of Mirandas. Miranda is a classic case of the white-identified Black professional. She did everything right. She went to college, graduate school, remained childless and single, and associated with the right white people. Miranda's false sense of security allowed her to be blindsided and her career permanently derailed. There are tens of thousands of male and female Mirandas in America, some of who were raised in predominantly white environments, attended predominantly white schools, and their closest friends and romantic partners, if they were lucky to have any, were white. It is understandable that these Blacks identify with whites. However, this is a problem for three reasons. One, they are not white. Two, they will never be white. And three, they believe they are equal to whites, which is never true in a white supremacy system. White identified Blacks are often fooled by the case in which they sometimes move about in predominantly white settings. In reality, they are such a small minority, they pose no threat or competition to whites. Unfortunately, white identified Blacks can't tell the difference between tolerance and acceptance. They are so determined to fit in, whites find their admiration and imitation flattering, and thus allow them to be in their company, as long as the Black person remains white identified. Since most white identified Blacks believe whites are the only people who can validate them, they will do whatever it takes to get white approval and distinguish themselves from the unwashed Black masses, even if that means reinforcing racial stereotypes against other Blacks and themselves. Miranda believed the extravagant retirement party for the Black vice president was proof that Blacks were equals at her company. She didn't know McCabe had been forced into premature retirement, or that the firm used the bad economy as an opportunity to eliminate the affirmative action positions, including hers, created to secure government contracts. Miranda didn't know about the countless humiliations McCabe had suffered at the hands of his white colleagues. She didn't know that the day after his first promotion a decade ago, McCabe came to work the following morning and found his desk had been moved into a small closet by the white supervisors, who resented sharing their office space with a black man. She never knew McCabe's eternal smile, which earned him the dubious nickname of Smiley, had almost cost him his health and his marriage. The male and female Mirandas do not understand or accept that skin color always overrides education, degrees, professional credentials, cars, clothes, white lovers, and white spouses when it comes to the core pecking order in a white supremacist society. That's why when they encounter racism, they have a tendency to ignore it unless they are forced to deal with it. They interpret this denial as confidence and strength, but it is just the opposite. Denial is the height of weakness. The good black is the most delusional of all blacks. Despite the mountains of overwhelming evidence to the contrary, good blacks like Miranda believe more education, degrees, designer clothing, fancier homes, addresses, manners, cars, white spouses, and biracial offspring will accomplish what Michael Jay, with all his millions, failed to do: erase the imaginary stigma of being black. Good blacks refuse to accept that no one, least of all a white supremacist, respects any black male or female who is willing to do anything, say anything, be anything, or betray anyone to belong to a club that doesn't want them as a member. A healthier, black-loving perspective. The psychological opposite of the white-identified black is the black-identified black. The black-identified individual sees the world as it really exists and does not blame black people for being the victims of racism. Since they are not in denial about racism, they are seldom caught completely off guard because they keep their expectations at a reasonable and realistic level. They understand that getting along with whites in the workplace does not mean whites see blacks as their equal. This is why most black-identified blacks seldom pursue friendships or relationships with white co-workers outside of work, to the relief of their white co-workers, and rely on black males and females for their psychological, emotional, and romantic needs. Chapter 24, The Zebra and the Lions, A Tale of Poisonous Individualism. Quote, O.J. Simpson is guilty of armed robbery and kidnapping, end quote, October 4th, 2008. One day, Horace, the zebra, got the craziest notion in his large, elongated head. He decided he didn't want to be a part of the herd any longer. He was tired of grazing where all the other zebras grazed. He was tired of the smells and the endless grunting and snorting. Zebras were absolutely disgusting. Horace spent most of his days staring for hours at his reflection in the river. He was the most handsome zebra in the herd, too handsome to be an ordinary zebra. Whenever one of the more comely females flicked her skinny tail in his direction, Horace turned his big snout up in the air. He wasn't about to bring any more smelly zebras into the world. Horace wandered away from the herd toward a shady grove of trees. To his delight, there was the sweetest green patch that had not been burned down by the blistering African sun. Horace looked back at the rest of the herd chewing blissfully on the dry tufts underneath their hooves and snorted loudly in contempt. Look at those dumb zebras eating dry grass like manna from zebra heaven. Horace moved deeper into the grove and faced the herd so he wouldn't be seen, but could see them if they came too close. If they discovered his tasty find, there would be less for him. Unbeknownst to Horace, 50 yards from the shady grove was a pack of lions, one male and three females. As Horace came closer, they strategically kept their distance. They wanted the zebra to think he was safe so far away from the herd. "What a dumb zebra," they growled deep in their throats with amusement. The pack licked their huge teeth in anticipation. The zebra was nice, thick around the middle with a big fat ass. "He doesn't do much running," one lioness chortled with contempt. She had no use for a lazy male of any species and was looking forward to ripping that striped hide with her sharp teeth until the blood flowed. "He's such a stupid zebra," a second lioness agreed, "to wander off by himself. Doesn't he know there are hungry lions in the fields just waiting to take him down?" "Oh, look at him," roared the male lion, shaking his magnificent golden brown mane, "chowing down like there's no tomorrow, and there won't be after we rip his striped ass apart." The lions laughed quietly so they wouldn't alert the blissfully grazing zebra. They were in a good mood. There was nothing predators loved more than a big-headed, stupid animal so arrogant it forgot its own safety lay in the unity of the herd. In a herd, the zebra's stripes created an optical illusion that confused the lions. To make matters worse, the more devious zebras would zigzag back and forth in front of the herd to make it more difficult to single one zebra out. Together, the zebras were smarter than they looked, but apart, they became a lion's happy meal. Oblivious to the danger beyond the trees, Horace ate until his big belly bulged. A shifting wind rippled the bristly hairs along his ridged back. His head jerked up and around. In an instant, he recognized the scent. Lions. He sniffed again, taking in large gulps through his flared nose. They must have seen him hiding in the trees. Horace trotted out of the shady grove and paused on trembling legs. Nervously, he looked back and spotted the top of a magnificent brown and gold mane moving low through the grasses, coming in his direction. Horace broke into a full gallop, his big belly swaying from side to side toward the herd grazing in the distance. His eyes widened with terror when he looked back and saw the lions four deep in hot pursuit. Horace brayed at the top of his lungs, calling the herd's attention to its plight. When the other zebras lifted their heads and saw the lions, they took off, leaving Horace in a huge cloud of dust. Horace couldn't believe these cowardly zebras weren't willing to risk their lives when he needed their help. How could they abandon such a proud, stately, handsome zebra like himself? Wasn't he just like them, only better? Before Horace could make another sound, one of the lionesses leaped into the air and landed on his back, followed by another, bringing him crashing down on his front forelegs. The male lion rushed in, snapped his powerful jaws around the thrashing zebra's neck, and clamped down until the zebra suffocated. By the time the last tremors rippled through Horace's body, the lions were already feasting. One lioness tore off a bloody chunk of zebra flesh and chewed happily. Poisonous individualism sure made one hell of a tasty meal. The end of story. Quote, "Even the weak become strong when they are united," end quote. Johann Frederick von Schiller, 1759 through 1805. Quote, integration was the worst thing that could have happened to Black people. You can't integrate into a culture that despises you. You can't integrate when you have to ask, beg for everything you need. That's not integration. That's subjugation. And if you don't know the difference between being equal and wanting to be equal, you never will be. End quote. Umoja.
Recipe number 9, false beauty standards. Once you convince someone to hate the reflection in their mirror, you can convince them of anything. Umoja. Chapter 25, The Beauty Con Game. The old cliches, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, is no match for the power of white supremacy. Under this system, beauty has become a zero-sum equation for whites and non-whites, which states, if whites are the most attractive, non-whites are the least attractive. If light skin is a sign of racial beauty, dark skin is a sign of racial ugliness. Black inferiority complexes are rooted in our mirrors. This false man-made concept of beauty is used to instill the first seeds of self-hatred and inferiority in non-white children, in particular, the darkest skinned of African descent. It is critical that we understand how the second weapon of mass mind destruction, beauty, function so that we understand why so many non-whites despise the person in their mirrors. Debunking white supremacy beauty myths. Myth number 1, we should take credit for an accident of birth. We have no control over the parents we have, the genes we inherit, or the color of the womb that delivered us into this world. Giving ourselves credit for being born white, black, red, or green, light or dark skin, 6'2" or 4'1", blue-eyed or brown-eyed, is the same as taking credit for having 2 hands and 2 feet. Our skin color is an accident of birth, a random toss of the genetic dice. To base our superiority on something we have no control over is foolish. We should only take credit for what we have personally accomplished. Myth number 2, God made whites superior to blacks. If this is true, then the following must also be true. God cannot be all-powerful and all-knowing because he made the African man and woman the first people on earth. He made a mistake. 2 inferior human beings, the African man and woman, can produce 2 superior offspring, the European man and woman. Myth number 3, Mother Nature is clueless and incompetent. Mother Nature, the physical manifestation of God, gave every species, including humans, the physical traits needed for survival. Europeans have straighter, longer hair that provides protection in a cold climate. Pale skin and light eyes indicates that whites have less melanin than more melanated people of color, and also indicates a native environment where there was less exposure to intense, direct sunlight. Mother Nature chose Africa as the birthplace of all humankind and chose the African man and woman to be the first people on earth. She equipped Africans with dark eyes, tightly spiraled hair, and the most melanin, which makes dark skin ideal for Africa's climate and intense heat and sunlight. Light skin, hair, and eyes are more desirable in a cold climate with less intense sunlight since melanin blocks the absorption of sunlight. Bottom line, the differences in skin color for whites evolved due to natural selection, genetics, and environment, not racial or intellectual superiority. Myth number 4, one beauty standard, European, fits all races. False. The physical differences between different ethnic groups are determined by genetics, the environment, and other biological factors. It is illogical and insane to judge all human beings by one beauty standard, just like it is insane and illogical to expect a Rottweiler to look like a Great Dane just because both are dogs. Myth number 5, the European beauty standard is a universal standard. False. It is illogical and insane for the white minority, 10% of the people on the planet, to be the standard for what is normal or desirable for the other non-white 90%. In fact, today's European beauty standards are the exact opposite of the beauty standards that existed hundreds of years before white supremacy infected the planet. Pre-modern Asian ideas on race. The text below is reprinted directly from the article universal preference of whiteness over blackness, courtesy of colorq.org. Standards of beauty in South and Southeast Asia. Marco Polo reports on the Dravidians of South India. It is a fact that in this country, when a child is born, they anoint him once a week with oil of sesame, and this makes him grow much darker than when he was born. In the Chinese record, Nam Sai Chow, a Chinese traveler to Southeast Asia, wrote of the people, "They consider black the most beautiful." Prior to European colonization, the ancient Visayans of the Philippines considered the very opposite of high noses and oval faces handsome. Visayans, as well as other Austronesian people in Malaysia and Indonesia, compressed their baby skulls to achieve broad faces and flat noses. Old Chinese views on Caucasians. The text below is reprinted directly from the article Universal Preference of Whiteness Over Blackness, courtesy of www.colorq.org. By traditional Chinese opera conventions, a black face is considered nobler. Actors wear masks that denote the character's qualities. A predominantly black face indicates courage, righteousness, and incorruptibility. A predominantly white face indicates craftiness, deceit, and knavery. Ming Dynasty China records even state that Caucasians, especially blondes, are physically unattractive. Hui Hui are shaggy with big noses. Quipchags have light hair and blue eyes. Their appearance is vile and peculiar, so there are those Chinese who do not wish to marry them. This distaste for blondes is a stark contrast to the worship of European standards of beauty so prevalent among modern Asians today. The character and beauty of Ethiopians admired by ancient Europeans. The text below is reprinted directly from the article Universal Preference of Whiteness Over Blackness, courtesy of www.colorq.org. The Ethiopians, wrote Herodotus, are said to be the tallest and best-looking people in the world. In ancient Roman-Greek writings, the term Ethiopian is loosely used to refer to all black Africans. Greek writer Diodorus wrote of the Ethiopians, "Their piety has been published abroad among all men, and it is generally held that the sacrifices practiced among the Ethiopians are those which are the most pleasing to heaven." If Europeans were living back in ancient times, they would be searching for cosmetic remedies to darken their skin and kink up their hair, like the millions of whites today who flock to beaches and tanning salons to darken their skin, to plastic surgeons to thicken their lips and enlarge breasts and buttocks, and to hair salons to perm, wave, kink, and curl their hair. Myth number 6, Africans worship the first Europeans as gods. False. Contrary to the racist delusions of Hollywood movie makers, Africans did not think the first Europeans were gods or goddesses. Some Africans believe Europeans were white because they had been skinned alive. Others, like Ulalda Equiano, were terrified by the appearance of the white men who kidnapped him from his African village and brought him to the New World on a slave ship in 1756. After 10 years of enslavement, Ulalda purchased his freedom and wrote his autobiography describing the horrors of slavery, the cruelty of slave owners, and how he fainted with fright the first time he saw the white men with horrible looks, red faces, and long hair. In pre-colonial Africa, a skin color inferiority complex was non-existent. Africans took pride in their skin, hair, and features because it was desirable, normal, to look like their fathers, mothers, siblings, and grandparents. Africans never knew they were inferior until the Europeans colonized, conquered Africa, and used physical differences to justify enslaving, robbing, raping, and murdering them. Only after 4 centuries of being force-fed these artificially created false European beauty standards, Africans and their descendants learned to hate what they saw in the mirror. Myth number 7. It is normal for one race to think a different race is more attractive, superior. False. It is abnormal to view another race as more attractive, just like it is abnormal to look into a mirror and see ugliness. A black child will not automatically think pale skin is superior to his skin, any more than a white child thinks his pale skin is inferior. Every child, regardless of race, has a healthy amount of self-esteem until he or she is taught to feel inferior. What happened to Black is Beautiful? The slogan, Black is Beautiful, which became popular in the 1970s, was little more than a good idea turned bad fad. By the time non-black merchandisers, blaxploitation filmmakers, and the media made a fortune from the Superfly hats, high-heeled shoes, idiotic films, and afro combs, black and proud became synonymous with black and foolish. We did not understand why such a wonderful slogan had been doomed from the start. We did not understand that we had to scrape off the rusted paint of self-hatred and inferiority before we applied a new paint job. We did not understand that in order to redo, we first had to undo. The telltale sign of past or present European colonization of a non-white nation, the people become self-hating. If European white supremacy beauty standards had not been literally rammed down the throats of millions of Asians, it is doubtful a single Asian woman would correct a non-existent flaw by undergoing eye surgery to make her slanted eyes rounder and more Western European. If European white supremacy beauty standards had not been literally rammed down the throats of Africans and their descendants, it is doubtful a single African man or woman would even think of using bleaching creams and swallowing poisonous pills, risking skin cancer, leukemia, thyroid disorders, and leprosy to lighten, destroy the most age-resistant skin on earth. Myth number 8. Whites benefit from white supremacy beauty standards. The beauty con game has boomeranged on the very ones it was supposed to benefit by breeding an unhealthy obsession with the exterior rather than the more important interior. This obsession is the primary reason there is so much unhappiness within the white collective over minor and non-existent flaws in their own appearances. Ironically, even though whites are supposed to be the most attractive people on the planet in a system of white supremacy, they are also the most dissatisfied with their own appearances and the most insecure. This predominantly white obsession with appearance perfection can be seen in the endless snake oil advertisements for the billion-dollar beauty industry. For the promise of whiter, perfect teeth, perfect noses, chins, thighs, abs, stomachs, lips, hair, skin, bigger breasts, wrinkle-free skin, potions, lotions, and the promise of staying young forever, millions of Americans swallow billions of pills and voluntarily go under the knife. This obsession with perfection is also apparent in the epidemic of eating disorders that are most common among the white female population, who ironically are also held as the standard of feminine beauty for non-white females. The truth is stranger than fiction in a white supremacy system. Despite the inferiority programming of non-white females, black and Asian women generally have a more positive body image than Caucasian females, according to a Washington University study. In addition, black women with a strong sense of racial identity actually rate themselves more attractive than pictures of supposedly beautiful white fashion models, and 40% of moderately or severely overweight black women rate their figures to be more attractive or very attractive. Other research indicates that this may be because black women are more flexible in their concepts of beauty than their white counterparts, who express rigid ideals and greater dissatisfaction with their own body shape. Another survey found black girls were more self-confident in high school than either white or Hispanic girls, and that white girls lost their self-confidence at an earlier age than Hispanic girls. How can this be true in a white supremacy system where the black female occupies the bottom rung of the beauty totem pole? Is the obsession to be perfect, superior, undermining the white female's self-esteem rather than building it up? Black girls with a strong sense of racial identity do not define themselves by false white beauty standards, nor do they totally depend on looks for self-esteem, but rely on other factors like personality, style, and intelligence. They know there is nothing inherently wrong with being black, and they are less likely to mutilate or surgically alter their bodies, which explains why so many black females view the eating disorders like bulimia and anorexia that afflict the white female population with puzzlement and contempt. Black females in general do not long for rail thin arms or legs or tiny butts. Their opinion of a sexy body is far more generous and forgiving, since perfection is never a requirement. Black females also have less of a tendency to obsess over minor flaws in their appearance. However, if a black female is white identified, she may mimic the self-hating behavior of her white peers, although seldom to the same extreme degree. White beauty standards are contemptuous of all women. Would a culture that truly values its females create a beauty standard that demoralizes and penalizes them? The answer is clear. It does not value them, but in fact secretly despises, even hates them. This contempt is obvious given the widespread slaughter of white females for entertainment and for profit in television, movies, and in real life. The white supremacy beauty standards actually demonstrate more contempt for white females than admiration. A culture that promotes a media-manufactured body ideal, tall, long-legged, blonde, and bone-thin with zero body fat, a boy's body, that drives white girls and women to literally starve themselves to death is anti-woman, not woman-loving or woman-respecting. This is not about empathizing with whites who are victims by their own hand. This is not about empathizing with white females who use the same racist standards to elevate themselves above non-white females. This is about exposing the blatant contradictions of a white beauty standard that even the white creators do not and cannot measure up to. The biggest beauty con game victims are non-whites who have been demoralized by the lie of white superiority. Is the epidemic of self-loathing the karmic price the white collective is paying for perpetuating mass self-loathing among non-whites? America is one of the wealthiest nations in the world, yet Americans are plagued by more self-doubt, self-hatred, self-abuse, over-materialism, dysfunctional relationships, broken families, cruelty, jealousy, envy, bullying, vanity, narcissism, eating disorders, self-mutilation, drug and alcohol addiction, mental illness, depression, suicide, sexual deviancy, rape, incest, and homicide than anywhere else, including the so-called third world. If the most privileged people on the planet are also the most miserable, they are missing the two most valuable lessons of their lives. There is no substitution for genuine self-respect and self-esteem. If you are mistreating others, you will have neither. If we escape punishment for our ill deeds and crimes, ultimately we will find a way to punish ourselves. Chapter 26. Straight talk about nappy hair. Don't remove the kinks from your hair. Remove them from your brain. The Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, 1887 to 1940. Baby, let your hair hang down. Audrey was sitting across a candlelit table from Ernest, a man she met a week before on the commuter train to work. She had dressed carefully for their first date, not too plain Jane, but not too sexy. She didn't want him to think she was willing to trade her body for a glass of wine and a plate of blackened tilapia. The conversation had been decent, but nothing special. Audrey had been hoping for some kind of spark, then warned herself to relax and just enjoy the man's company. That was the problem with single women like herself. They expected for an instant connection with a man they just met. For all she knew, Ernest was having the same doubts about her. "This fish is delicious," Audrey said, letting him know she appreciated the meal he was paying for. "Not as delicious as you," Ernest said, bold brown eyes staring over his raised cocktail glass. "You know what they say, appearances can be deceiving," Audrey teased, refusing to take his comment seriously. She was a little flattered by his constant staring, but also a little unnerved. Finally, she asked, "Is something wrong?" "Wrong? You keep staring." "Just wondering," his voice trailed off, a wistful look on his face. "About what?" Audrey mentally crossed her fingers. "Please don't let this man say something stupid." "I was wondering what you look like if you let your hair down." "Let my what down?" She sat back frowning. "It's sexy," Ernest continued, "when a woman lets her hair down." He tilted his head back and rolled his shoulders to demonstrate. "Uh-huh," Audrey said, a self-conscious hand straying to the French roll she had plastered with hair goo to keep the short, stray hairs lying flat. "If I was your man, would you let your hair down for me?" "But you're not my man, so I don't have to answer that," Audrey said firmly. "I might be one day." Now why was he going there on their first date, and why was this fool talking about letting her hair down when it barely reached her shoulders? Unfortunately, Audrey knew exactly what Ernest meant. If she had seen that tired scene once, she had seen it 100 times. The prim and proper, plain Jane, white female, hair in a tight bun, glasses, white blouse buttoned up to her chin, who hadn't had sex since the Great Depression. The handsome male hero walks in the door. Bam, instant attraction. The top button of her blouse pops loose. She reaches up and pulls out that one strategically placed hairpin, shakes her head, and her long hair tumbles around her face, transforming her from a frigid librarian into a raging sex kitten. When Audrey was younger, she wanted long hair like that. But now, just a few days short of her 40th birthday, she was no longer impressed with Hollywood's idea of sexy. She thought it was fake, silly, and too contrived. In fact, spending too much time and money fretting, fixing, and worrying about her hair was wearing on her last nerve. She was sick of waiting for hours at a beauty salon, sick of hair relaxers, hair straighteners, and hair rollers. She was sick of trying to stretch, pull, and shape her short hair into a decent style every morning. Audrey had decided that this would be the year to throw away the relaxers and curling irons and start wearing her hair natural. And now this clown wanted to turn her into a piss-poor imitation of a white female? 10 years ago, Ernest's careless comment would have made her feel inadequate, or it might have driven her to the nearest hair weave salon to accommodate his inappropriate and frankly rude expectations. Ernest had no idea how much he had turned her off, or that this would be their last date, because he was still smiling and waiting for her response. "Ernest," she cooed, giving him a seductive smile, "I'll let my hair down on one condition." "What?" Ernest leaned forward, an eager look on his face. "You let your hair grow long and silky so I can run my fingers through it." Then Audrey's eyes traveled slowly and deliberately up to the balding spot on the top of his thinning, close-cropped nappy fade. The end. The joy of nappy humor. Don Imus and his crew take aim at the hair and sexual morality of 8 black teenage girls on the Rutgers basketball team, April 4th, 2007. Imus, host. "So I watched the basketball game last night between a little bit of Rutgers and Tennessee, the women's final." Rosenberg, former Imus sports announcer. "Yeah, Tennessee won last night. 7th championship for Pat Summitt, I-man. They beat Rutgers by 13 points. Imus, "That's some rough girls from Rutgers. Man, they got tattoos." McGuirk, producer. "Some hardcore hoes." Imus, "That's some nappy-headed hoes there. I gotta tell you that now, man. That's some woo." "And the girls from Tennessee, they all look cute." McGuirk, "A Spike Lee thing." Imus, "Yeah." McGuirk, "The Jigaboos vs. the Wannabes, that movie he had." Imus, "Yeah, that was a tough..." McCord, newsman, "Do the right thing." Imus, "I don't know if I'd have wanted to beat Rutgers or not, but they did, right?" Rosenberg, "That was a tough watch. The more I look at Rutgers, they look exactly like the Toronto Raptors." Ruffino, engineer, "Only tougher." McGuirk, "The Memphis Grizzlies would be more appropriate." Nappy hair has been a frequent target of white ridicule. There is a tremendous amount of pressure for black women to imitate a beauty standard that was designed for white women. This makes hair a sensitive topic for many black females. Even though black males are not pressured to have long hair, straight hair, good hair, or any hair at all, they are just as obsessive and conflicted about black hair. Only one has to turn the clock back 40 years to recall the conch styles that were once popular among black males. A short walk down memory lane. The conch was a popular hairstyle for black men from the 1920s to the 1960s. The naturally kinky hair was chemically straightened using lye and styled into pompadours that resembled white hairstyles. Some men chose to simply slick their straightened hair back to lie flat on their heads, like white males. At home, a do-rag headscarf had to be worn to prevent sweat or weather from making the conked hair revert back to its natural nappy state. Relaxers had to be constantly reapplied as new hair grew in. Malcolm X on the conch hairstyle. "This was the first really big step toward self-degradation when I endured all of that pain, literally burning my flesh, to have it look like a white man's hair. I had joined that multitude of Negro men and women in America who are brainwashed into believing that the black people are inferior and the white people superior, that they will even violate and mutilate their God-created bodies to try to look pretty by white standards. Look around today, in every small town and big city, from two big catfish and soda pop joints to the integrated lobby of the Waldorf Astoria, you'll see conks on black men and black women wearing these green and pink and purple and red and platinum blonde wigs. They're all more ridiculous than a slapstick comedy. It makes you wonder if the Negro has completely lost his sense of identity, lost touch with himself. If the conk was a form of self-degradation for the black male, are hair straighteners, perms, and hair weaves inflicting the same kind of self-esteem damage on the unsuspecting black female? A classic case of the pot calling the kettle nappy. Despite the black male's own history of hair obsession, he is quick to belittle black women for all the time and money they spend on their hair, forgetting that he is the one who rewards black females who come the closest to the white beauty standard. The black male's hypocritical and contradictory pride in his own blackness is seldom extended to black women who refuse to straighten their hair, imitate white beauty, and proudly and defiantly wear their natural hair short, braided, locked, or dreadlocked. Black females who wear their naturally nappy hair often run the risk of being labeled as less feminine and less attractive by black males than their long perm hair female peers. When black women try to live up or down to the unreasonable standards forced upon them by white society and black males who often openly admire white features, they are ridiculed for wearing hair weaves, wigs, and horsehair. Some black comedians who wear their own hair and locks as a sign of so-called racial pride often use black women's hair as the butt of their unbelievable and nappy hair humor. Now, they aren't hoes, but there were some nappy-headed women on that team. Those are some of the ugliest women I've ever seen in my whole life. Black comedian D.L. Hughley on the Jay Leno's Tonight Show, May 7, 2007, joking about the black girls on the Rutgers University basketball team. Three facts some black males conveniently ignore. 1. Black females' hair is the same hair that grows out of their own scalps. 2. Their genetics are 50% responsible for the hair of the black female. And 3. Their ridicule of and contempt for the black female's hair is an announcement of their contempt for themselves, their genetics, and the hair on their own heads. Men set the beauty standards for every culture. In male-dominated cultures like America, men, not women, set the standard for feminine beauty. Once this beauty standard is established, the women fall in line by conforming or trying to conform to these standards. The most powerful males in a male-dominated society use the most desirable females to enhance their status in the eyes of other males. The women strike a similar bargain, trading their youth, fertility, and beauty, high status, for financial security, marriage. Do not confuse status with validation. In a male-dominated society, women cannot validate men. Only men can validate other men. The same is true for women in a male-dominated society. Women do not validate women. They compete with other women. Only men can validate women. Make no mistake. The black community is a male-dominated society. It does not matter that black females head up almost 70% of black households. This is an economic and political reality, tragedy, not a cultural choice. Like all males in a male-dominated society, like America, most males in general reject female leadership. However, most women, and black women are no exception, actually welcome male leadership. In other words, most black men will not follow black women, but most black women will follow black men. The proof? The preacher, the politician, the pimp. Whether it is the church, the meeting hall, or the street corner, black men usually lead. Black women usually follow. With a few exceptions, black women are the foot soldiers and seldom the generals in most black organizations. When it comes to female beauty standards, black males, like all males in a male-dominated society, decide what is desirable and what is not. In nearly every culture in the world, women look to the men in their culture to validate their self-worth and value as women. Why is this so important to understand? Because males collectively have the power to psychologically devastate females collectively if they do not validate their worth as females. For example, white male supremacists elevate the thin, blonde, blue-eyed, and pale-skinned female because she has the highest genetic value in a society that prizes whiteness and lightness. White females are programmed from childhood to accept this narrowly defined beauty standard and will judge their own beauty value as females by this standard. To attract men, a desirable mate, millions of white females imitate or try to imitate a beauty standard set by white males so they can be validated and socially, financially, and romantically rewarded by white males. We know this is true because the astronomical number of white females of all ages and incomes who dye their hair blonde and starve themselves to be thin. The black beauty standard for black females, light skin, long hair, and European features, is based on the same white supremacy standards. Black females learn the painful lesson at an early age that the most powerful and influential black males, as well as many average and ordinary black males, reward black females who are closer in appearance to the white standard of beauty. The proof? The light-skinned, Asian, or white wives and girlfriends of the most influential and successful status-seeking black men. Black male invalidation of black females. Detroit headline: a local DJ and club promoter cancels party that would let light-skinned black women into the club for free. 2007. In their attempt to gain status, some black males seek validation from the male with the highest status in a white supremacy society, the powerful white male. When the black male deliberately chooses the female with the highest status, the white or the white-appearing female, he is unconsciously reinforcing his own inferiority as a non-white person. Even if she does not articulate it, the black female knows instinctively that the black male's foolish choice of white status over honoring his female mirror image is unjust and is the greatest possible betrayal that a man can commit against the women of his own race. This unspoken but obvious resentment accounts for a great deal of the black woman's anger towards black men. If the black female cannot depend on the black male to validate her worth as a female, who then can she turn to for protection? If the black male refuses to validate and value the black woman, the black womb, how can he validate and value himself? Perhaps this explains his callous disregard for the black female and why black males slaughter each other without hesitation. In 2007, when Beyoncé appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated's annual swimsuit issue, angry white readers demanded subscription cancellations. One reason given by a white male subscriber: my daughters grew up identifying with the models in the swimsuit issue and wanting to be like them. How is my daughter supposed to see herself in Beyoncé? The white male collectively understands the potential devastating effect on the white female psyche when a non-white female is elevated above the white female, even for something as trivial as a magazine cover. White males understand collectively that in order to validate themselves, they must validate and uplift the white female, the white womb. Together, this reinforces the value of white life. The black male is encouraged to do just the opposite, uplift white females and degrade black females. Yet the black male does not understand why black life, including his, is so cheap. If black males took a page out of the white male's book, flip their tragic and self-genocidal black scripts, and collectively embrace their female mirror images in all shades of brown and black, wearing a crown of natural hair, the companies that profit from hair weaves, wigs, permed hair, and skin bleaching products would go out of business. Black males would then reap the rich psychological and spiritual rewards of loving themselves by elevating and honoring the black womb that delivered them into the world. Bottom line, black males must accept some of the blame for the time, attention, anxiety, and insanity displayed by some black women about their hair. How the beauty con game penalizes black males. It is a gross contradiction lie for a black male to say that he loves himself yet desires to have children who look nothing like him. Emoja. The black male's secret shame of looking and being too black explains his collective disrespect towards black females, and it explains why so many successful, status-seeking black males deliberately choose non-black females. This has less to do with non-black women being more desirable and more to do with what non-black women represent to the self-esteem-starved black male who measures his success by white male standards. Where have all the shampoo girls gone? Recently, a black male blogger from Chicago asked, "Where are all the white girls with the long, shiny hair I see in those TV shampoo commercials? I never see them on the bus or the subway. They don't work downtown like I do or party in the suburbs. I have never once seen hair like that on a white female's head." The glorious manes seen on TV require hair additions, weaves, falls, wigs, sophisticated lighting techniques, film and photo retouching, and artificial substances and devices to add volume, curl, density, color, and sheen to the hair. These media-manufactured false television images are the primary reason so many females of all races are so dissatisfied with the hair growing out of their scalps, and why so many women of all races chemically process, lengthen, straighten, thicken, curl, wave, kink, and color their hair to enhance it. Different is beautiful. Black hair is unique when compared to the hair of many other races. It is only through the lens of white supremacy, black inferiority, that this difference becomes a demoralizing focal point for many blacks. Mother Nature, the physical manifestation of God, made us perfect in God's sight. Our hair serves a sacred purpose in its natural state, growing up toward the sun, like a spiritual antenna that connects us to our Creator. The self-loving black male and female embraces the softness, texture, durability, and versatility of black hair. They know hair can't cook, clean, make love, comfort us, earn a living, save a life, nurse us back to health, fix a flat tire or a leaky faucet, or raise a healthy, happy child. They know that hair, be it long, short, curly, wavy, kinky, or straight, is only a small part of what makes a man or a woman desirable. The self-loving black male and black female know from experience that a long head of hair shrinks in importance if what lies beneath the scalp is wholly unappealing. A person obsessed with the exterior is already inferior in his or her own mind. Emoja.
Context of white supremacy. First audio segment all done. We will share a few thoughts, perhaps hear a word or two from Pam the Great, and then we will get back to the second audio segment. The number to dial if folks have commentary, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Ooh, pardon, had to cough. Folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, feel free. We're about halfway, a little more than halfway through the book, so you can be picking out major themes, things that have stood out as we have been reading the text. If folks, particularly if this is your first time reading the book, certainly I know we have people who have been listening to Pam over the years and got the books, you know, years ago or way back when. Especially if this is your first time reading the text, certainly interested in hearing your thoughts. I think we were right on time. I knew I had already played the audio segment where Pam talked about Miranda, The Color of Success. I knew I had already played that as an intro for workplace racism recently. And in fact, I played it at the very beginning of the program before we went live yesterday. So I didn't want to play it again today, even though that was, you know, exactly the section that we were covering. But I did play it early before we went live, just so that people got to hear some of Pam's additional comments about that section, which I thought was very important. With that, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. If folks could
take about 5 minutes to share. If you have thoughts, questions, comments, take about 5 minutes, and make sure I also get in my quick thanks, gratitude. Our narrators, Red in Vegas, Medi, phenomenal work, much appreciated. That is labor doing the narration. For any folks who've done any voice recording before, I can tell you from my experience, it is work. I certainly appreciate you two pitching in and doing the recording. We listeners appreciate it. Job well done. Super professional. Excellent work from our narrators. With that, folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Gus. Poor Miranda. She needed to call into workplace racism. White identified blacks, is that a term that we can use, Gus?
It does seem like it's kind of bordering on name calling. It's kind of the same thing, showcase blacks. It seems kind of bordering on name calling.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Although I got exactly what she meant. I thought it was a good way not to say the C word. Or the UT word, you know. Seeing it happen time and time again, my code at work is I refer to the desk that they give me as the desk that you allocated to me, or the area as the area you designated to me, because I never want to feel comfortable, because I know that at any time something like that could happen. I've been in that same situation. She pointed out, she was on point with her breakdown of the people being classified as black and the so-called white people's beauty standards. The only people I've seen using bleaching cream and masks here in Harlem that is being classified as black is the African people. I've yet to see sisters from here or sisters from the West Indies who are also being classified as black use a bleaching cream. I think it's really a condition on the continent. Now, the white women beauty standards is an illusion, and our women are definitely being confused. So are our men, but she focused mostly on the women in that chapter. The skinny, long hair, or as Al Bundy would say, small feet and big tits, you know, that standard of white women beauty has changed somewhat to fake butts and fake lips, and they're being purposefully thick. They're getting cheekbones added and chins added, and they have their hair braided, and some of them got dreadlocks, or locks rather. And I see once again our women following them, both using the old and new beauty standards. They have a fake butt too, but now they got a blonde wig down all the way to their butt, you know. It's just really confusing, and I agree with her that that's, of course, white people's fault, but the men in our society, it's our fault because we've accepted that as something that is appealing to us, as opposed to saying we don't want that. And, of course, if we're not going to look at that, then they're not going to, portray that image. They want to attract men. And what I disagree with in that chapter, though, that small piece, and I'm waiting to hear the rest of it, is to say that the black men are like sort of like a patriarchal society amongst our people. I think that that's I disagree with that. I think that the same standards apply to women. Men don't validate other men's beauty standards. Men dress to attract women. And if women decided tomorrow they don't want men in skinny jeans or, you know, their pants hanging down or whatever, if one of them approached them, no, I don't date guys that, you know, tomorrow those dudes will have the belt on and their pants up. So I think that it's a two-way street in our society, rather. And I'll mute my line, Gus.
Oh, Thomas in New York flexing his black male privilege, denying patriarchy. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I'll just say briefly, the final segment about black hair, I really appreciated that part. Growing up here in California, it's a lot of white identification, a lot of white programming to think that you're less than, that you don't measure up to. Appreciated that part. Now I'll just mute my line there.
Concise. Much obliged. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Miranda, the story of Miranda, it's basically most people who have worked in corporate America, like myself, probably can't identify with her experience, even though I wasn't that much confused as Miranda was. I knew I was a black man in a white society. But there was a couple of things that, you know, working in corporate America, especially at a younger age, you don't see until you leave corporate America. But one of the examples that pointed out to me was the political ignorance of black people in regards to, you know, which party is better for us, the Democrats or Republicans, and, you know, the baseline they always use is, you know, how much money they make. And, you know, or how much money they can get. So they tend to not understand that both parties are white supremacist parties that are not looking for their best interests. The part about the Asians having their beauty standards kind of like white people. I was in the Philippines a couple of months ago, and I was looking at big billboards about, you know, white soap whitening creams and stuff like that. And you would have thought, like, in a non-white country like the Philippines, you know, they would be proud of what they what they are. But apparently, you know, European colonialism and white supremacy has infiltrated that country as well, because now everybody in the Philippines wants to be white, and everybody wants to look white. And, you know, on their TVs, you see nothing but light-skinned Filipinos with, with a nation that's basically majority, you know, non-white, particularly dark Filipinos in that country. And the slogan of black is beautiful, and how Pam talked about how that slogan kind of, you know, went wrong, kind of reminds me of what happened with Kwanzaa, and how they kind of commercialized it, just like what she mentioned with Black is Beautiful. It's like, you know, the same thing with Kwanzaa and, you know, the commercialization of it, even though Kwanzaa originally was supposed to be about, you know, black self-respect and, you know, having a blueprint of some semblance of black self-respect. So that's all for now, me, my line.
Much obliged. Other folks who dialed in, world system of white supremacy, not surprising about what's happening in the Philippines, unfortunately. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. It's a lot to process. I'll try to stay on course with 2 points. Number one, as far as the example of Miss Miranda, I would say, because what was said in the reading is that she spent her childhood in environments where it was a lot of white people. Well, I would say I don't know how long ago that was written or anything, but I would say with the technology that the global system of racism, white supremacy has, that example can be with non-white people of all different levels of finances and income. They can be around, they can spend their entire childhood, quote unquote, around non-white black people, and still with the thoroughness of the global system of racist white supremacy, still end up confused and in the position of confusion that Miss Miranda, the example was of. Just an observation of mine. Although the story is good for a book to put in, and it's very identifiable for a reader who needs to have a verbal understanding of racism, white supremacy, and how a non-white person can get confused until life, actually. I take the position that there is no such thing as a black male under the global system of racism, white supremacy, dominating anybody, not even other black males, as far as they're concerned. If anything, it's equal in the point of needing a lot of help and assistance and improvement. It is black males, as far as that concern, based on the results of the global system of racism, white supremacy. It can be corrected, that's for sure. I would say, I'm going to try to say in terms of nature, females in general have the ability to influence everybody within their social connections, other females, children, and males. Certainly the global system of racist white supremacy strategically have been in a manipulative way, not a constructive way, but a very manipulative way, with the idea in mind to refine continue the system of racist white supremacy, have been investing into a lot of black females, as example of quote unquote college employment, overwhelmingly in some cases over non-white, racially classified non-white black males. And that's all I have to say right now. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Seems like we might have had another teaspoon of black male privilege. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from, if you have a commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, sir. I'll be here.
Mr. Demery Four, yes, sir.
Okay. greetings, guys. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. Okay. I'll start out also with Miranda. And she kind of, you know, until recently, I didn't see this, but it kind of, she kind of put me in the mind of Omarosa. You know, it's kind of, you know, kind of see her in that kind of image. But one thing I noticed is the way she was carrying herself, although she was in one of the most segregated cities in the nation, she said that she had never personally experienced racism, except for occasionally white ignoramus who disliked blacks. I was at one of Dr. Welsing's seminars, and there was a young black female that said the same thing, that she had never experienced racism before until she had gotten in this particular area around the nation's capital. And, you know, that stuck with me, and I even asked Dr. Welsing later on one of your shows, you know, what she thought about that. And then you have to think, well, that's just being dishonest, because why was she at the seminar in the first place? So some of these things, you know, some of it's just lies. You know, that lady had to experience. But we would like to hear from somebody who has made it through, you know, so many years, college and job performance, that has not experienced racism. I think you asked all the time, just have them call in. We'd like to hear from them. And the white-identified blacks, like they said, is probably a better word, is a confused blacks, or the people who consider, if you can't beat them, join them. And then I think that those type of people should stick by their work. I mean, if it comes out that you were wrong in the end, then either stick by your work or, you know, change some of what you're doing. I noticed in that story, as opposed to the zebra and the lions, one thing in particular, in the end, although the zebra wanted to get away from the other zebras, when he was faced with trouble, or when it went down and the chips were down, he was running full gallop back towards the herd that was grazing nearby, and was even perplexed why they didn't, you know, risk their life to try to save him. And you see that a lot in some of these people that choose to go a certain way, and then when it don't go quite the way that they expected, then they run back into the folds of black folks. And I think in OJ's case, we even accepted him back in for a period of time. But a couple other things about, you know, the way the black male and black female relationships are affected, you know, by this racist brainwashing and the white chips that's planted in our heads, is genuine self-respect and self-esteem. You know, not mistreating, you know, other people. I liked all of her, the myths that she busted during that and portion of the text, and especially like the part with Malcolm X. You know, he came clean because we know from his autobiography he was dating a white woman at one time, and influenced him to straighten his hair and show some invalidation towards the way that he felt he looked. But we can all get over that, you know, with information and a healthy self-image. But you know what? Denying that it does not exist is not going to get us anywhere. We have to realize that. I would say, like, it's one thing I highlighted here about a black male that chooses a white female as a love interest or a couple. You know, he probably has to come to terms that he may not completely like himself. And one last thing is about the hair. One thing I found, yeah, I may be wrong, I may not, but a lot of black guys that shave their heads, I think that they're doing that, you know, because I think that white females would prefer that bald head because they seem to have a problem with the curly locks of a lot of black males. I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Interesting, Mr. Demery 4. Other folks who dialed in, hand up. If we've not heard from you, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
I'm here.
Greetings, Ivy. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you. Did I interrupt you?
No, ma'am. No.
Okay. Pull up my notes here real quick. Shout out to Red. Like, she's a great reader. Like, it was awesome. And thank you for doing this book. Red, and greetings to you, Gus, and to everyone online. Well, I agree with Thomas in New York. I'm going to try to say this fast, that men do stuff to attract us. Like, they get muscles and they, you know, try to get, you know, fancy cars and money and things like that to impress us. This is not a male-dominated society. It's a white-dominated society, and I'll get back to that in a minute. Most black men do not kill each other. 86% of black men, they have black wives, and for those that make over $100,000, 83% of them have black wives. They're not responsible for our hair insecurities, because, I mean, black women, we tear each other down as well as far as hair is concerned. Ultimately, white people are to blame for all that because we've all been brain trashed. I wanted to say, you know, just about this black male privilege society not being a male dominated, that is white dominated. There are more black men unemployed than black women. Black women get more loans than black men. Black women own more businesses than 61% of black owned businesses belong to black women. Black men get paid less than all women except for Hispanic women. And throngs of white men were fired for mere accusations of sexual harassment by white women. Patriarchy didn't help them, didn't help Bill Cosby, didn't help Emmett Till. Patriarchy does not exist. Black male privilege does not exist. I will mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Appreciate the data. Dating reference data or marriage data. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we have missed you completely, line should be open. Proceed. Do we nab everybody? Everybody with a hand up who wanted to share? Did we get them? Great. I will hush my mouth and make room for Pam the Great. This is from summer 2011, about 2 months after the book was originally published. She came back on the program to talk about the text, The Religion of White Supremacy. This is Pam the Great. Black love is a revolutionary act.
I mean, it's almost like a textbook that they follow, some kind of rule book they follow in the entertainment industry. Talking about, particularly describing black women in such unflattering terms, tough, mean, you know, and then getting black women to attack each other, and then getting black men to attack other black men. And it's almost like, you know, you look at it and you just think, are we seeing what's really going on, you know, or has it become so normalized and satisfying to please white people because we know on some level that we're trying to appease and appeal to white people. When I did it, I mean, I was never extreme, but if I said something negative about another black person to a white person, I could feel that positive energy flow, you know. But I don't remember hearing white people say negative things about other white people to me. And I think listening to this show and actually thinking about it, I became more aware of the fact that it's black people that do most of the talking when it comes to talking about other black people. Black people will sit there and talk about another black person to a white person. And it is seldom. I don't even remember any time where a white person has defended that black person. But that same white person will not have that negative conversation to you about any white people unless it's a white person that's in power over them that's mistreated them. That might be the only time a white boss that they don't like that did something, they might say something about them. But their coworkers and their peers don't say anything about them, very little. You know, when you were saying that, we will degrade other black people, put other black people to appease or please or fit in with white people, it's almost like we're not paying attention because there's nothing that black people can say or do that somebody black hasn't said or done. Get a master's degree, makes no difference. Get a fancy title, makes no difference. You get rich, makes no difference. There is nothing new under the sun that black people could do that will make this thing change. I mean, in terms of getting white people to accept them as fully human. Black people have been trying for a very long time. But it's almost like you're programmed. I remember there was this this really highly publicized Cape Cod murder trial in 2006 of this black male who was accused of raping and murdering this white female. And there was one black male on the jury. And later this white female juror reported that this black male juror told her that all his brother's wives were white, that he had always been around white people, and that he did not like blacks because look at what they are capable of. Now, this is a black male juror sitting in on a trial of another black male, and he says, look at what they are capable of. Now, had that same black male juror been on trial himself, he would have been faced with the same racism and the same type of thinking that he was probably guilty, but he couldn't see that. So even though he was saying these things to white people, he wasn't buying himself anything. He wasn't benefiting in any way. Somebody told me, and I don't know if this is true, but they said that Gayle King, you know, Oprah's pal, supposedly said, and I'm sure she said this to an audience, if it was said at all, that if she asked somebody, you know, if she talked to somebody about the O.J. Simpson trial, a black person, and they say that O.J. Simpson was innocent, that's the last time she'll talk to them. Now, I don't know if that's true. Maybe I shouldn't be repeating it. But my point is that who was she really directing that comment at? White people, if indeed she said it. So you see it constantly where black people are really talking to white people. And sometimes we'll do it. We'll talk to white people and we'll say something we think white people want to hear. And it comes out so easily, it's almost unconscious until you stop and hear what you're saying. You know, and for some strange reason, it's a satisfaction that comes from putting down another black person publicly or putting down another black person in front of a white person. And I would just say that goes back to the training that we've had for hundreds of years. And it's really been a survival training. You know, it's the same reason that black people used to beat their children in front of the slave master as a way of saying, don't beat them anymore. I took care of it. So black people know that white people are dangerous, and they know why we're afraid of white people. And so I think that's one reason we're constantly trying to appease them is that we're trying to, you know, say that, listen, you know, I'm not going to be a problem. I'm with you. I mean, it's I don't even know how to describe it, but I think it's behavior that we need to start becoming conscious of. In the book Black Love, we have a chapter called Slave Traditions. And a lot of things that we do today are slave traditions. The religion that we practice is a slave tradition. The way we treat our children, a slave tradition. The way that we talk about other black people, a slave tradition. So a lot of things we do are things that come right out of slavery, the food we eat. You know, what we call soul food a lot of times is food that we were forced to eat because it was that or go hungry. And now this food, this throwaway food, has become a delicacy. Delicacy that's killing us. So a lot of the things that we do are things that come out of slave tradition, even to the point of killing each other. mistreating each other, using ugly words against black people. You know, it was something that I kind of thought of, and I was wondering if other people have ever heard this. I've never heard this. I tried to imagine. I've never heard a white person say, "Ain't that just like a cracker?" I've never heard an Asian person say, "Ain't that just like a chink?" I've never heard white people say after they had a romantic disappointment with another white person, "That's why I don't deal with white people." Never heard a white person say, "With your white ugly ass." I've never heard an Asian person say, you know, anything like, "With your Asian ugly self." I mean, you think about the things that we say, and it just flows off our tongue like water. And so I think it's really important that we start really listening to the words. Words are powerful. Appeasing and pleasing white people is a slave tradition. Slaves were forced to call other slaves niggas in front of white people when they were slaves. What are we doing today? I guess we're still slaves. Or at the very least, we're still slave-minded. I mean, reality is we're still on the plantation. Slavery never ended. We never got off the plantation. We're still on the plantation. But I think the only way we're going to get off the plantation is we got to start being honest about the fact that we're on the plantation. We got to start being honest about the fact that these showcase blacks don't represent progress. And we got to start being honest about our feelings about ourselves and each other. Because you can't cure a problem that you don't admit you have. And I think it's time for us to man and woman up and face the music and decide, you know, either we're going to do this thing, we're going to correct this thing, or we're going to perish. And I don't mean to sound dramatic, but no people can continue down the road we're going on and survive. I just don't see it happening.
Pamela Evans Harris, black love is a revolutionary act. One note that I will add, folks have any other comments that they want to share, what they heard either from the audio or any additional comments from the first portion of the reading that we did today. I was asked about the term white identified blacks, and I would not recommend the use of that term. As I said, it's very close to name calling, unless a person has said, "Oh yeah, I am a white identified, you know, black person, you know, that's me." It would be name calling, but also it makes it seem as though whoever is saying these are white identified blacks is not white identified themselves. And I don't think any victim of white supremacy can truthfully say, "Oh yeah, I've been born in this toxic environment that, you know, is bursting, is rife with white supremacy that has infected everything, all areas of people activity and literature, the schools, everything. That I have been in this environment for, you know, 5 days, 10 years, 50 years, 90 years, I've been here, and I'm not white identified at all. I've read so much counter-racist literature and done so much studying. I have totally purged all of, I mean, I don't think anybody can truthfully say that. If you are a victim of white supremacy, you are white identified in some way, shape, form. I think that's just the truth. So at least in my view, saying white identified blacks, it makes it seem as though there are some black people that are not white identified, and I just don't know how that would be true. I could be in error. If I am speaking wacky, then please speak up clearly, immediately. Did other folks have commentary they needed to share?
Yes, sir. What you're saying, yes, sir, what you're saying makes sense. Definitely makes sense. This is why Mr. Fuller states of three categories, white, non-white, white supremacist. Also, what would be relevant is victim of racism, white supremacy. That would be name calling, in my understanding. Another word that needs to be eliminated out of our vocabulary is the word Hispanic. I keep hearing that word coming up when we are articulating and attempting, anyway, counter-racist logic and understanding. And that word comes up all the time. It is in my understanding, is a specific weapon that is used by white people under the system of racism, white supremacy, and the effects is confusion to non-white people, the word Hispanic. And I'm especially keen on it because I am here in South Florida, where it definitely is used. I hear it used a lot, especially by, unfortunately, a lot of non-white people who are racially classified as black. I hear that word a lot. I mean, I put it up there. I put it up there with I put it on the same level of confusion with the word fair. Yeah, I mean, it's just as confusing, and it should not be used. And that's all to say for right now. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Did any other folks who dialed in have commentary that they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
In regards to the white identified black person, I understand your point. However, I think when Pam clarified it and said that all blacks are white identified to a smaller degree or lesser degree, I think she kind of clarified it where we're all at one point or another white identified, because she says that we were brought up in a white supremacist culture. So, I know what you're saying about how it could be viewed as, you know, name calling, but I see it differently from, you know, just using the C word or the, you know, or the UT word, where that was put on us by white people. So. Just my opinion. I mean, my life.
Other folks have commentary that they wanted to share.
If you have time, can I? Go ahead, man. Sorry.
I didn't even know if I could be heard. Gus, can you hear?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay, because I didn't hear you. I wanted to say desegregation didn't break up our happened to us. What broke up our families was the war on black people, so-called the war on drugs, because and out is we're like around 10% like white people, and
your line is breaking up a little bit.
Yeah, it's like 25%.
We can hear you, but then the sound will just disappear for a second or two, and then it'll come back.
Is this any better?
If you want to maybe start over, give us a few sentences and we'll see.
Replace white supremacy with justice. Is that any better?
Good so far.
Okay. I was just saying that desegregation wasn't the worst thing that happened to us, and it didn't so much break up our families as much as the war on drugs, which supposedly was really the war on black people, because those of us who were never married was at about 10%, which is like the same as white people's, before the war on black people called the war on drugs. But then after the war on drugs, it plummeted to where those of us who were never married went down to like 25% of us, which is like really high. And, you know, just this thing about desegregation being the worst thing that ever happened, that to me is something that is used to blame Dr. King and the people who fought for desegregation. And I understand that he blamed himself, because he said that he led us into a burning building, or he thought he did. Well, actually, that's not true at all. Ultimately, our building was not burning until they came and burned it up. We was somewhere and they came and burned up our building. He didn't do that. They came and burned our buildings down. They still do. They are scientific terrorists, as you would say. And I like how previously in the book that they said that the way that we can solve, that we will solve white supremacy is to change our reactions to it. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Ivy. Thank you for being persistent. I just, before retired firefighter, words are critically important in my view. Mr. Fuller, producejustice.com, Mr. Fuller, for decades has talked about saying, and really even saying when he was first hearing the terms, that that was a part of what motivated him to, you know, codify his response, and saying that, you know, you do not integrate a system of white supremacy. You don't desegregate a system of white supremacy. The words are not even designed to produce, you know, an accurate understanding of the problem. That's why just really emphasizing that words are crucially important. Not understanding racism, white supremacy, perhaps that would be more accurate to say that, quote unquote, destroyed black families. But just saying that's really, really important. I've heard him, you know, talk about that for years. Integration, desegregation, these are not even designed. These terms are not even designed to reveal truth, promote logical thinking about this problem. Retired firefighter.
Yes, I very much like the example she gave with the zebras and the zebra versus the lions. And a thought came to my mind somewhat in the terms of a question. Were the zebras guided by a code or something that's considered to be natural of being together? I think they were guided by a code, which is to me would be an excellent example as far as what non-white victims of racism, white supremacy should gather around is a code. And from that, you would find yourself in company with others because to a large degree, codified understanding is being is based on logic. We don't have to never have to physically see each other to be basically on the same level of understanding of correctness anyway, by following a code that's based on logic. And I think that the story with the zebras, you know, it brought up questions in my mind as I was listening to that story. And that's all it says. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. You want to share one question that came up while you were hearing about the zebras?
What's that now?
You want to share one question that came up in your mind as you were hearing the story about the zebra?
Oh, that was it. The example, the question would have been would be to anybody else that's on the line. You know, do you think that the zebras were guided by a code? And that particular zebra was actually going against a logical code, and in turn paid the price for it. Does anybody else think that is a does that make sense? It can possibly be a question that I would be asking to anybody else on the line.
Yes, may I be here?
Yes, sir.
I think the firefighter may have something there because in the illustration, if they stayed close together, if they were attacked because of the stripes and the way they were running, it may confuse the enemy and greater they make their chances greater of escape. But it was my understanding that, you know, we all know that there may be some safety in numbers, but according to Mr. Fuller, black people have a herd mentality, and just the fact of sheer numbers, actually won't do anything as far as safety for you without, like the firefighter brought up, a code which that you're living by. I mute my line.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery. For you,
Gus, can I? I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Ivy.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Sorry about that. I wanted to ask you, what term would you use to, I guess, describe what is known as integration and/or desegregation?
Well, I generally just put those terms in quotes if I'm going to use them, if somebody else is using the terms, or if I'm talking about, you know, like the 50s and 60s, I'll say that, you know, that's what they were saying that they were attempting to do, quote unquote, integrate. I'll just put the terms in quotes, but I would and I try to point that out specifically that, you know, these terms are just not accurate. They don't reveal truth about what people are trying to address. And that's, you know, why this ends up not being successful consistently, just not having an accurate understanding of what problem we're trying to solve, and having inaccurate terms often can be a big part of why that can be a huge problem. And I think it was deliberately so with those terms. But yeah, I would just try and put them in quotes or, you know, the same way that you did, quote on what they call integration, the so-called integration, put it in quotes, and then try and point out specifically what the problem is with those terms.
Do you know if Mr. Fuller has any, for lack of words, alternative terms, since he you know, pointed out that they're inaccurate?
Well, at least from what I've heard, and I've heard him a few times discuss this, I think some of it might be when he was a guest on this program and other times, because I've heard some of it, it just goes to the fundamentals of, you know, why he started to codify what he was saying and really paying attention to words. And I think the main thing that he emphasizes is not that these terms need to be substitute, or if anything, the substitute would be system of white supremacy. The problem is not integration. What I've heard him say specifically, what are you talking about? How close do I have to be to a white person before we are what you say integrated? Do I need to be, you know, 2 feet away, 5 feet away, 10 feet away? How close do I have to be before we are now integrated? How many black people have to be integrated? Like, these are just the questions that you would go through to say, you know, this is using logic. This is not addressing the problem. This is not a problem of white people and black people being in proximity or in the same room or in the same bedroom. That is not the problem that we're trying to address at all. The problem that we're trying to address, cross out integration, segregation, desegregation, the problem that we are trying to address is the system of white supremacy. I think that's would be the substitute. But I mean, you could call and ask him directly, but I suspect that would be the substitute. System of white supremacy. That is what we are trying to correct, abolish.
Okay, thank you. I'm your line.
Can I say something on that right quick?
I reckon.
I would say the racist white supremacists use both words to their best interests, and primarily non-white people, unfortunately, attempted to use a useless term called integration for several decades. Matter of fact, I was forced to go to a quote-unquote school with white people. And like you mentioned, the ridiculousness of the word integration. Well, how close are you supposed to be to white people? And is that going to be some sort of benefit, you know, as far as they're concerned? Just confusion. Thank you.
master deceivers, and just the importance of using correct terms, which Pam talked about specifically many times on this very broadcast, the importance of using correct terms. And that's something hopefully all of us are trying to get better at as we proceed. Did we have a final thought, comment, anyone need to get in that'll take like 30 seconds before we get to the second audio segment, or everyone satisfied for now? I will assume everyone is satisfied for the time being. Pamela Evans Harris, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. We are going to audio segment number two. If you have comments that you did not get to share, write them down. We should have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. So you can, you know, if you have a question or comment, whatever, we should have time for that as well. The Cows, audio segment number two.
Chapter 27, How the Language of White Supremacy Penalizes Black Females. The white supremacy culture defines beauty by what is normal and desirable for white people. Pale skin, hair, and eyes. This combination is considered the most beautiful, especially for white females. This color bias can be found in the commonly known phrases, "She was the fairest, lightest in all the land," and "the fairer sex," where fair is equivalent to white and fairest in the land is equivalent to white beauty, meaning white females are the most feminine and the most beautiful. The lightest, fairest female who is blonde, blue-eyed, and pale-skinned occupies the top rung of the beauty pedestal because she helps to maintain the illusion of white superiority. She is always assumed to be beautiful, regardless of how attractive or unattractive, or extraordinary or ordinary, that particular pale-skinned, blue-eyed blonde may be. The irony and gross contradiction of this false beauty standard is the most beautiful blondes in Hollywood history, Jean Harlow, Jane Mansfield, Marilyn Monroe, Lonnie Anderson, and Pamela Sue Anderson, were born brunettes. The reverse is true for the most masculine, sexually desirable male in a white supremacy society, who is often described as tall, dark, and handsome. This definition of male beauty may give the dark-skinned black male an advantage in the proverbial bedroom, but it puts him at a disadvantage in the society and corporate arena. It also serves to connect the word dark with the word masculine and illustrates how the language of white supremacy penalizes the dark-skinned black female. The triple demons of racism, sexism, and colorism. The black female in a white supremacy system is victimized by the triple demons of racism, sexism, and colorism, and faces more discrimination than any other person on the planet. The black female is confronted on a daily basis by a hostile white and black world that systematically degrades and denies her natural beauty. Starting as young as 4 or 5, little black girls are taught that dark skin is unattractive and black hair is bad hair, and must be straightened or permed so she will look presentable, less black. This destructive message follows black females well into their adult years. The black female seldom sees her own unique, natural beauty positively reflected on the TV screen, in magazine ads, music videos, or as the romantic female lead in a motion picture because dark, feminine, and beauty contradicts the lie of white female supremacy. Because of her consistently cruel treatment at the hands of blacks and whites, the black female has a sometimes well-deserved reputation for having a bad attitude. This bad attitude is largely a reaction and defense mechanism against a black-hating, female-hating, and black-female-hating world that is often perceived correctly by the black female as hostile and threatening to her self-esteem, physical safety, and psychological survival. Do not misinterpret anything said here as pity for the black woman. This is not an attempt to make excuses for bad behavior or an attempt to speak for black women. The black female is not to be pitied. She is to be admired. Despite her cruel treatment over the last 500 years, the black female's style, language, innovation, creativity, courage, dancing and musical talents, intellectual brilliance, dignity, and physical features are imitated and duplicated all over the world by non-black females. An unconscious black celebration of self-hatred. It's like when you have coffee and it's too black, it's too strong. so you have to add milk to it. You add enough milk, you completely weaken it. If you add too much milk, you won't even know you had coffee anymore. Malcolm X. In the black community, the light-skinned female or black female with a white parent is uplifted as the ultimate sex symbol because she looks more white, while the brown and dark-skinned female is seen as sexual chattel or the butt of ignorant, self-hating black humor. In Toni Morrison's novel, The Bluest Eye, Picola Breedlove, a little black girl believed that if she were white, the world would be hers. In Alice Walker's novel, The Color Purple, Celie was told by another black person that she would never be anything because she is poor, black, ugly, and a woman. When a black female is disrespected because she is not white enough, we are unconsciously worshiping and submitting to white supremacy and advertising our own self-hatred. Instead of celebrating the purity of our heritage and the richness of our melanin in the black female's beautiful dark skin represents in our ignorance, we celebrate the infusion of white blood into our genetic pool, even when it was a result of 400 years of rape. When black people openly or secretly uplift lighter-skinned blacks over darker-skinned blacks, we are not only celebrating slave traditions, we are celebrating slave owner traditions. Stolen black beauty. According to the 2009 American Society of Plastic Surgeons report, females account for 91% of all cosmetic procedures. The most popular include breast augmentation, lip augmentation, face lifts, skin laser treatments, and butt implants. European beauty standards have always associated full lips with beauty, youth, and sexuality, which explains why the Western medical beauty industry is frantic to create methods to duplicate them. For example, around 1900, surgeons injected paraffin wax into lips of white females without success. Liquid silicone was used in the 1960s to enhance lips until the fear about silicone stopped the practice. Currently, cosmetic surgeons are working on a procedure that allows them to use segments of neck muscle as lip grafts to plump them up. Obviously, cost is no deterrent when it comes to mimicking the beauty of black females, since a single collagen lip treatment can cost $400 per injection, and lip enhancement procedures can range anywhere from $500 to $5,000. It is undeniable that the black female's round buttocks, full breasts, voluptuous lips, and age-resistant, melanated skin are among the most prized and coveted physical features among the white female collective. The proof? The mass production and mass implementation of the black female's uniquely beautiful racial characteristics gross millions of dollars for plastic surgeons every year. In light of the above facts, how can the black female still be the most degraded female on the planet? One logical answer: black females must be inferior in a white supremacy system. Openly acknowledging the beauty of the dark-skinned black female breaks the fundamental rule of the white supremacy beauty con game. A non-white female cannot be equal or superior to the white female. This explains why the black female's most coveted features, full lips, breasts, and buttocks, had to be disconnected from the black female and reconnected to a white or a near-white female using the awesome power propaganda of the white media. However, the illusion of the superior white female flies in the face of the reality of butt implants, breast implants, face lifts, liposuction, chin implants, curly perms, collagen lip injections, Botox, nose jobs, hair weaves, colorful skin and eye makeup, cancer-causing suntans, and tanning salons to add color to pale skin. This blatant imitation and duplication of the inferior black female explains why the white media feverishly promotes the round buttocks of a white-looking Jennifer Lopez and the big lips of Angelina Jolie to claim and rename black beauty in the name of whiteness. Several figures been straining for a better look, while a male figure at the far right of the image even holds his seeing eyeglass up to better behold the woman's body. The European observers remark on the woman's body, "Oh, goddamn, what roast beef," and "Ah, how comical is nature." In 1810, Sir Archie Bartman, known as the Hottentot Venus, was lured from her South African village with promises of becoming wealthy and famous. She was exhibited like a circus act, exploited, ridiculed due to her unique anatomy by white standards, and forced to entertain white specters by shaking her buttocks. She died in 1815, penniless and heartbroken. Even death offered no relief from humiliation and exploitation. Her brain and genitals were put on display in Paris until 1974. Several prints dating from the early 19th century illustrate the sensation generated by the spectacle of the Hottentot Venus. A French print entitled La Belle Hottentot, for example, depicts the Cosan woman standing with her buttocks exposed on a box-like pedestal. Decades after her death, the Hottentot Venus inspired white females from America to Europe to adopt fashions that gave them the appearance of having a protruding buttocks, like the inferior black females. The uniquely beautiful features of the black female are still the targets of ridicule by the white media, clearly ignoring the hundreds of thousands of white females who pay thousands of dollars, risking their health and in some cases their lives, to undergo risky plastic surgery and skin tanning to look less white. Which brings to mind a critical and revealing question. If the black female is the least attractive female in a white supremacy society, why are her unique physical characteristics the most sought-after cosmetic and surgical procedures by the most attractive white female? Imitation always exposes the lie and reveals the truth. Chapter 28, Why Black Female Entertainers Must Wear Weaves That Look Like Weaves. Tyra Banks swears off fake hair for her show, August 23, 2009. Tyra Banks will be keeping it real on her talk show this fall, it being her hair. The host announced Monday that she's swearing off extensions on the new season, starting September 8th. No fake hair at all, she tweeted. Will be the hair coming out of my scalp, for all to see. In a press release, she said the show aims to help women own and rock what they've got and be. Months after her announcement, Tyra Banks announces her show will end after current season, December 28, 2009. Wrapping at the end of its fifth season in the spring of 2010, it will be lights out for the show that brought viewers memorable weave-exposing, cellulite-revealing, and tear-jerking moments. Banks will focus on the launch of Bankable Studios, a NY-based film production company currently reviewing possible projects. If your hair is relaxed, white people are relaxed. If your hair is nappy, they're not happy. Comedian Paul Mooney. In the spring of 2010, black filmmaker Tyler Perry hosted an hour-long show on the TV Guide channel to promote his new movie, Why Did I Get Married Too? When the first cast member, Jill Scott, a talented singer and actress, joined Perry on the stage, she looked like a beautiful black queen in her curve-hugging black dress and perfectly groomed afro. However, as one of her scenes in the movie played across the screen, it was hard not to wonder with dismay why Miss Scott had to wear an unflattering weave instead of wearing her own beautifully natural hair. Miss Scott is not alone. It is extremely rare to see a black female entertainer wearing her own unprocessed hair that hasn't been bleached or hidden underneath an expensive wig or an unrealistic-looking weave. This is not intended to ridicule black females or their hairstyles. It's true, white females enhance their natural hair with chemicals, weaves, hair pieces, and extensions. However, they're enhancing, not disguising, the ethnic characteristics of their natural hair. The opposite is true for today's black female entertainers who wear weaves that do not match their natural hair texture, length, or color. Another difference between black females and white females who wear weaves is the vast majority of weaves reinforce white, not black, beauty standards. Is weave wearing by choice or by demand? We propose it is the latter, that black female entertainers must wear unbelievable weaves that look like weaves if they want to make it in the entertainment industry. How do unbelievable weaves promote white supremacy? There are seven obvious benefits. Benefit number one, no matter how sexy, talented, or beautiful a black female entertainer is, her unbelievable weave subtracts major beauty points and guarantees that the beautiful black female will never be seen as competition or as a threat to the throne of white female supremacy. Benefit number two, unbelievable weaves make it appear that black females are imitating and envying the superior white female. Imitation may be the sincerest form of flattery, but not when it degrades the imitators. Benefit number three, Unbelievable weave-wearing black females are the best advertising white supremacy can buy and help maintain the illusion of the superior white female by promoting white supremacy beauty standards. Benefit number 4. The rich and famous unbelievable weave-wearing black female celebrity is the most visible role model for young and not-so-young impressionable black females, which is easily observed by the distressing number of black females who wear unflattering, easily detectable, and unnatural-looking hair weaves. Benefit number 5. Wearing unbelievable weaves destroy the self-esteem of the unsuspecting black female who knows subconsciously that the enhanced image in her mirror is based on something that is not real. It confirms in her own subconscious mind that her own beauty is non-existent. Benefit number 6. Unbelievable weaves program black boys and black men to see black females as fakes, frauds, second rate, and wannabe white females who do not like, respect, or value themselves. The main one who benefits from unbelievable weaves is the white female, who now looks genuine article to black males. This reinforces her superiority and the inferiority of the black female and has a disastrous effect on black male, black female relationships. Benefit number 7. Black females make up the largest share of the multi-billion dollar hair care industry, largely due to the explosion of hair weaves. According to the 16th annual report on the buying power of Black America by Target Marketing, a black consumer research firm, blacks spend almost the same amount, $7.4 billion, on hair care and personal products that we spend on education, $7.5 billion. The same white-owned hair care companies that shunned black consumers in the past are dominating the black hair care market to the delight of some misguided black females who may get a psychological boost from using hair care products that are designed for the white female's hair because it makes them feel more acceptable and more beautiful by white standards. The black female hair care market is the beauty industry's biggest and most disrespected cash cow. This may explain why there are no nationally advertised products designed for the natural hair of black females. Is natural hair a no-no for black females? Was Paul Mooney right when he said our natural hair makes whites unhappy? After reading the evidence below, the reader can judge for him or herself. The evidence. 1987, woman fired for cornrows sues Hyatt Hotel in Virginia. Cheryl Tatum, a cashier, was fired from the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Crystal City, Virginia, for her refusal to change her extreme cornrow hairstyle. Tatum, a black female, filed a lawsuit against the hotel, charging race discrimination and seeking back pay, punitive damages, and attorney's fees. 2000, FedEx fired several black employees in New York for wearing dreadlocks. 6 years later, FedEx reached a settlement agreeing that dreadlocks could be worn for religious reasons. 2006, Claire Anderson, a Marietta, Georgia teacher, is planning to file a lawsuit after she was fired over her hairstyle because her hairstyle did not fit the image of the school. After she began to wear her hair combed out in a full afro, she was called to the office and fired. 2006, Fox TV's divorce court judge, Maybelline Ephraim, was fired after failing to reach an agreement over pay and her hairstyle. According to Ephraim, Fox demanded that she wear a wig to expedite the hairstyling process. Since she wasn't willing to agree to the terms, she stepped down after 7 years of hosting the successful court show. 2007, Donna Tate Allison, a guard at Hainesville Correctional Center, was fired for violating the Department of Corrections grooming policy, which forbids extreme and eccentric haircuts. Tate Allison, a 46-year-old black female, wore her short dreadlocks pinned underneath a hat. Another black female corrections officer, Juanita Hudson, who wore her hair in cornrows, was informed that cornrows, dreadlocks, and braids would not be allowed. After a 2-day suspension, 1 day after receiving a favorable performance review, Hudson took her braids out. 2010, ABC TV reported a story about two black women who were denied employment at the Six Flags Amusement Park in Largo, Maryland, because their locks hairstyle was considered offensive by Six Flags management, which did not permit any hairstyles that detracts or takes away from Six Flags theme. One black female job applicant was informed by a supervisor that management was adhering strictly that year to their grooming policy, despite the fact that Largo, Maryland area is 93% black. Why do some whites find natural hair on black females so threatening? One answer. Once the black female embraces her natural beauty, her self-respect will skyrocket. The day she stops imitating white beauty, white supremacy, and embraces her own God-given natural beauty, black normalcy, she will ask herself, what other lies have I been taught about myself? The black mother is the first teacher of the next black generation. Once she sheds her former degraded self, her new eyes will help her daughters and sons to see what has been there all along, right in front of their eyes, the majesty of their African ancestors. Her sons will embrace her natural beauty and stop looking elsewhere for the beauty within themselves. The black male will take her cue and will see the black female with new eyes and will see his own reflection in her beauty. His self-respect, self-esteem, and sanity will skyrocket as he stops believing the lie, looking outside himself for what is right inside himself. And that is not an acceptable outcome for the black male, female, and child in a white supremacy society. Umoja. Complexions. An essay by Mark Twain, white male author of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. Nearly all black and brown skins are beautiful, but a beautiful white skin is rare. Where dark complexions are masked, they make the whites look bleached out, unwholesome, and sometimes frankly ghastly. I could notice this as a boy down south in the slavery days before the war. The splendid black satin skin of the South African Zulus of Durban seemed to me to come very close to perfection. The white man's complexion makes no concealment. It can't. It seems to have been designed as a catch-all for everything that can damage it. Ladies have to paint it and powder it and cosmetic it and dye it with arsenic and enamel it and always be enticing it and persuading it and pestering it and fussing at it to make it beautiful, and they do not succeed. But these efforts show what they think of the natural complexion as distributed. As distributed, it needs these helps. The complexion which they try to counterfeit is one which nature restricts to the few, to the very few. To the 99 persons, she gives a bad complexion. To the 100th, a good one. The 100th can keep it. How long? 10 years, perhaps. The advantage is with the Zulu, I think. He starts with a beautiful complexion, and it will last him through. And as for the Indian brown, firm, smooth, blemishless, pleasant, and restful to the eye, afraid of no color, harmonizing with all colors, and adding a grace to them all, I think there is no sort of chance for the average white complexion against that rich and perfect tint. Chapter 29. Straight Talk About Beauty. Civilized versus Primitive Beauty Standards. Americans and other technologically advanced societies spend billions of dollars to artificially enhance what nature did or did not give them. Body and face paint, artificially produced suntans, hair weaves, wigs, hair pieces, toupees, hair transplants, makeup, lipstick, eyeshadow, hair color, tattoos, piercings, and plastic surgery are used by millions of civilized people to make themselves more appealing to the opposite or the same sex. What then is the real difference between a woman from the Central African Sara tribe with lip plates and a white woman in Hollywood, California with breast implants, breastplates? How is the New Zealand Maori warrior with facial tattoos and body markings more primitive looking than the white male college student in Paris, France with body piercings and tattoos? The westernized beauty con game is a multi-billion dollar industry that has claimed billions of victims of all races by creating a false standard of beauty for whites and non-whites. In order to keep the billions pouring in, the industry must set the bar for beauty, normalcy, impossibly high to keep the white and non-white populations insecure. Then, the industry can sell cosmetic solutions for imaginary imperfections. The world's biggest beauty secret. The biggest beauty secret on the planet cannot be found in a $300 vial of skin cream or in a pair of skilled plastic surgeon's hands. What is the secret? Could it be the infusion of African genes into the European gene pool that gives pale skin more color and a deeper tan, makes hair thicker, wavy, or curly, and adds more sensuousness, fullness to lips, noses, and other facial features? If one studies the history of Africans, Moors, who traveled the ancient world and conquered Europe long before Christopher Columbus sailed to America, one might imagine that swarthy, dark, and olive complexions, dark, curly, wavy, and wavy kinky hair, dark hair, eyes, and full lips in some parts of Europe may be visible evidence of African genetic influences. While this cannot be stated as scientific fact, it is certainly not an unreasonable theory. If, as scientists have claimed, all human life began in Africa, every man, woman, and child is a modification of the original African man and woman. Links and sources available on website. True beauty is not for sale at the cosmetic counter. True beauty is not a small pointy nose, long blonde hair, or a bone-thin, pale body. Beauty is in the look in a lover's eye, the curve of a woman's cheek, or a man's broad, strong back. It is a smile that lights up a face, or a laugh that makes us smile. It's the graceful way someone moves or dances. Beauty is eloquence, intelligence, wisdom, kindness, and determination. God gave all of us something special, a special quality or gift that no one else in the world possesses in the same way we do. God's greatest gift can be found in a pair of eyes that sparkle, in the hands of a doctor who delivers a new life into the world, or a powerful voice that makes the angels weep. Or it might be the greatest gift of all, a kind, intelligent, loving human being. Mother Nature gets the last word. Is there a beauty standard that is objective, logical, and can be applied to all human beings regardless of race? Absolutely. Who is qualified to set this standard? The most powerful force on earth, Mother Nature. Mother Nature is the visible, physical, and tangible manifestation of God, the final judge of all that is good and perfect in this world. Mother Nature does not acknowledge beauty or ugliness based on artificial, man-made standards. Mother Nature does not put more value on an eye because it is blue than she does on a brown eye. Only man and woman, in their endless foolishness, put more value on superficial, useless differences than they do on the value of a human life. The shape of a nose, the color of an eye, the length of hair, or a jutting chin is a matter of taste, not proof of racial superiority. There is no functional purpose straight blonde hair has that is not also present in dark nappy hair. Is a blind blue eye superior to a brown eye with 20/20 vision? What does Mother Nature consider beautiful? A strong body, limbs without deformities, healthy skin, teeth, vitality, good vision, hearing, and speech are beautiful to nature. But the most important trait in every species is invisible to the human eye, the ability to reproduce. Yet the most fertile female on the planet, the black woman, is the most demeaned woman on the planet. Again, the question is, could the true emotion that fuels so much contempt for the fertile, full-lipped, full-hipped, curvaceous black female be envy? Mother Nature may have already answered that question.
Context of white supremacy. Pam the Great. Black Love is a revolutionary act. That will wrap it up for this week. We'll pick up next week, session 5, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions, comments that you would like to share, the number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you did not get to share at all after the first audio segment, you should definitely get your hand up right now, *61. Do not wait until the last 5 minutes. If you didn't get to share at all, we can go ahead and get you immediately. But all of the folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
If a first time tonight caller doesn't respond, I would like to say something.
Feel free, retired firefighter.
Greetings again, everyone. Yes, I You know, I was just thinking with this, with to comment on this, on the second half reading. It's our, the irony of it all is that as far as individually, the features that are commonly associated with the people who identify themselves as white, the individual features, which is different, quote unquote, colored eyes, blonde hair, pale skin, the majority of that, of those people who have those features individually are considered to be non-white people. It's sort of an irony as far as that concern, being that people who identify themselves as white, which is a political construct, make up such a tiny, tiny minority of people on the planet. But what I wanted to, what came to my mind, since I kept hearing the word beauty over and over again tonight, and no pun against Miss Emmy, because she sounds so attractive even saying the word when she identifies us as quote-unquote beautiful people. I would like to read and or remind through reading Mr. Fuller's word guide on the word beauty. Do I have permission?
Let's hear it.
Beauty / beautiful person. Avoid using these words to describe any persons who exist in a known universe during any time that the system of white supremacy, racism also exists. Instead of saying that a person is beautiful, say that the person is attractive. When others say that a person is beautiful, ask them to explain in detail why that person is beautiful or is a beauty. Reason. During the existence of white supremacy racism, the people of the known universe either practice or tolerate the practice of white supremacy racism. According to compensatory counter-racist logic, a quote-unquote beautiful person does not practice, nor does he or she tolerate the practice of white supremacy racism or any other form of injustice, non-balance between people. Therefore, as long as white supremacy racism exists, and as long as injustice, non-balance between people exists, there are no people in the known universe who can correctly be identified as beautiful. As long as the people of the known universe are not in balance with each other, it is best and correct to describe any persons who do things that attract you to them as persons who are attractive. It is important to know and to understand that people can attract other people for reasons that are correct or for reasons that are incorrect. And that's the end of Mr. Fuller's recognition of the word beautiful. Thank you.
Much obliged. Much obliged. How beautiful can you be practicing racism or being subjected to it? Other folks who dialed in, if you have questions, comments, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just quickly, as I was following along with you know, the beauty con game that Pam eloquently describes and the business behind it, and the entertainers, especially the non-white black females, I just kept getting this image of the rapper Lil' Kim and what, you know, how she has become victimized by this whole part of white supremacy in regards to beauty. And I remember seeing a picture of her just recently, and then seeing a picture of her when she came out in the mid-90s and how beautiful she looked when she first came out, and how, you know, her being confused and being victimized by this whole beauty con game made her, you know, just, you know, what she is today. So that's all I have. I'll be my line.
In my view, if you want to take, since Little Kim was the reference point, you could say she is a white identified black, or you could say she is a victim of white supremacy. In my view, the latter would be more accurate. Not that, you know, you can say she is white identified for sure, but I do just try to caution against making that a label for a person or groups of people. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, my beer.
Mr. Demery 4.
Okay, I just want to comment on the why black female entertainers must wear weaves that look like weaves. And you would think that if you were a producer or like Tyler Perry, you create these scenarios and you have the ability to put everything together to tell your story, that you would, you know, have the freedom to allow your actresses or entertainers to, you know, be themselves naturally. But that doesn't seem to be the case. And then Pam and her, the way she writes, you know, she gives seven benefits. What is it? Seven? Yeah. Seven benefits to the white supremacy system, you know. And I just focused on benefit number six, unbelievable. We's program black boys and black men to see black females as fakes, fraud, second rate, wannabe white females who do not like, respect, or value themselves. And then I thought about Dr. Umar and when he was going to start his school, and he wanted the black females to wear their hair natural so everybody could get used to, you know, being natural and not, you know, putting these straightening combs in your head, or you were just going to be yourself. And I could see the value of that now in his, you know, projection of the school that he wanted. And I'll mute my line on that. Thanks, Greg.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery 4. Other folks who dialed in, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943 pound. Other folks, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Ivy here.
Greetings, Ivy.
Ivy.
I want to say about the, what was it, $7 billion on hair care and personal products. The thing about that is that that's another one of those racist stats, and I'm not accusing the authors of practicing racism, of course not. But the terrorists who put those stats out to begin with, because that's where you get them from. You get them from white people. Thing is, hair care is something that we need. You need to take care of your hair. And I think a lot of that has to do with actually us going natural, because you don't need all these products if you're just going to get a weave or, you know, some fake hair or some added hair. I'll put it like that, some extensions. But it takes a lot more for us to take care of our natural hair. And that's why some of us do, you know, wear weaves and perms and things like that, because we just don't know how to take care of our hair. We were never taught. Also, it's very slick the way that the races the way that they put that stat out there, because they said hair care and personal products. Well, personal products is hygiene and all of that. Like, that's not a lot of money to spend on things that you need. That's another one of those, oh, you know, Black people and Black women are spending too much money on something. And yet again, we're coming with something that we actually need, just like the shoes, like, you know, personal products. Well, the thing is, probably you're not spending enough money on education if you're spending just as much money as we are on things to sustain our lives. So maybe you need to spend more money on education. And that's obvious anyway, because, I mean, Black people are terribly undereducated. The same is true for white people as well, but not nearly as much as us. So trying to think if there was anything else I wanted to say on that. I just to sum up, Black people are not doing anything incorrect by the money that they're spending on taking care of their hair and taking care of their bodies. And white people need to spend more money on education. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Consistent, 2 days in a row, consistent. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed. Folks, everyone satisfied for the time being? Grand, I will hush one more time, see if we can get in one more audio segment from Pam the Great, and then I will maybe add a word quickly, maybe add a word in on the text, but let's see. This is Pam the Great. She was talking about this book specifically, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, and she was talking about hair, which was a big feature in this week's portion of the book. Get this one in quickly. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, 2011, from the archives of the Cows.
This is the South Carolina caller. I'm just listening. I am enjoying the program, and I do want to make one statement. I don't have a partner. I'm not in a relationship, so my expression of Black love cannot be a revolutionary act at this time. But my revolutionary act for the past couple months has been wearing my natural hair to work, and it's going pretty well. I get some strange looks from the white people, but I have gotten some support from other non-white people. So that's my revolutionary act.
Okay. You know what? If you want to send me a picture of you in your beautiful natural look, I'll post it on there, on our website.
Okay. I certainly will
do
that.
Yeah. And, you know, we can give you all the love and support you need. We'll put it on our website. So congratulations. Yeah.
But I do definitely enjoy listening to you whenever you're on the program.
Thank you. And you know our website, www.chosenhorse1.com. So, you know, just shoot me an email and, you know, a picture of your choice, and we'll put it on there.
Okay. All right. We'll do.
Okay. And you can look at yourself all the time. Make it a screensaver.
All right. Thanks.
Pam the Great, I was speaking of consistent. You can look back over the 7-year period that Pam was a guest on this platform, and that is something all the way through, consistently encouraging, motivating, supporting other Black people. With the text that she wrote, with people that wrote her, with feedback about her books, or things that she said, if they heard her, you know, on this platform or wherever else, that was so consistent. She encouraged so many other people to write. It wasn't just, we could put, you know, your picture in the book or on the website. It was, we could post your article in our book or on the website. There were so many people that she encouraged to do that or to start their own websites. That was so consistent. She really made an effort to try to encourage and support Black people as best she could. That is something that was consistent with Pam the Great. I think that's one of the reasons you heard from the caller in South Carolina in that segment. I always enjoyed hearing her on the program. I think that's one of the reasons that so many people always were grateful when Pam dropped by. I did say, since I do have, we have a little bit of time, not a whole lot, but a little bit of time before we wrap up this week's segment, the portion about Black males taking some of the blame for the beauty con game and the hair issues that Black females have, I do not accept that because, in my view, Black males, they are also victims of white supremacy, at least for all of the Black males that are on the planet right now. The system of white supremacy has been in existence for centuries before any of us were born. I don't know how this group specifically would be culpable at any level. I mean, even, you know, 1% culpability for any of the problems, not just, you know, beauty, anything else that you want to pick out as victims. I'm not in charge of anything. I don't have say so on anything. I'm, you know, been brain trashed just like every other victim of white supremacy on the planet. So to me, that's not logical that Black males would have to take some of the blame. And I remember reading that in the text way back when and going to address this with Pam specifically, that I did not think that was accurate. Just didn't seem to make logical sense to me, but just got distracted and was not able to address it directly. Although there were certainly other things that I did address directly where, you know, we had a different viewpoint on racism. But yeah, I do not accept any of, as a Black male, I reject that. I do not accept any of the culpability for that. And to me, it just doesn't seem logical. Also, the segment in the second audio reading that we did today, where it's was talking about beauty standards and how Black females are penalized, and Black males, since it's the standard is tall, dark, and handsome, that Black males maybe have some sort of advantage. I think that sort of suggestion is incorrect because, again, top 10 all time, Delectable Negro, because Black males are also raped. And that's something that she talks about, Pamela Evans Harris talks about specifically in the next book, The Interracial Con Game. Black males are raped by white men and white women and have been for centuries throughout the history of the system of white supremacy, as have Black females. But Black males being raped is not something that is talked about. And in addition to that, the Black misandry that Dr. Curry talks about and that is talked about in The Delectable Negro, that since there might be a sense that that Black male might be a threat competition, Dr. Welsing's theory of white genetic annihilation, that he's going to be subjected to even more abuse and terrorism to make sure that that Black male does not have access to any white women or even sometimes any non-white females. Make sure that he doesn't have access. You got a substantial, you got those prison strikes operating right now. I don't think those Black males, no matter how tall, no matter how dark and handsome they may be, I don't think they are exercising any sort of sexual escapades while they are in greater confinement. I don't think that's happening. So that is something that I thought was significant. Two points where I have a significantly divergent view than what was presented in the text. And certainly, I do not think there is a society that is dominated by males. I think all of the leaders of Black people are white. All of the leaders of Black people are white. I do not think Black males are leaders of the Black community or of black people. I do not think that at all. I don't think black males are even leaders of themselves. I do not think black people are male dominated. I think it is white supremacy dominated. I think the statistics evidence bears that out. Might be that you just got a third serving of black male privilege on the broadcast. I guess that could be possible as well. Any other folks have commentary they needed to get in? Last few. We have about 5 minutes before we get ready to conclude, so you should go ahead and speak up immediately if you have commentary or question.
Yes, sir. I would just like to say that I have been attempting to further encourage non-white black females to only be concerned about their hair and the way that the creator created it. And so therefore, every time that I, not every time, but a lot of times, almost on a daily basis, I compliment non-white black females on their hair. I won't do it if there is a non-white black female whose hair is not in its natural style. I won't do it because it would cause some sort of distinction between the two, and they are both equal in my opinion as victims of racist white supremacy, and I don't want to have the attempt to contribute towards solving a problem and creating more problems. So I wouldn't do it, but for the most part, I do compliment non-white black females on their hair in its natural style. I myself, I have been completely bald-headed since 1990, and I did it as to have an emphasis on the over identification that we have with hair in itself, to imply that it's more important on what's inside your head, not on what's on the outside of your head. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thought the caller raised the theory earlier about why black males may be shaving their hair. Anywho, other folks have commentary that they wanted to share before the program concludes.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Ivy.
I just wanted to say I really miss Pam. Like, she's incredible. These clips that you have been playing. I miss your commentary too, Gus. I do think this is a beautiful tribute that you've done and that you're doing, yielding to her. But I am glad that you added in your commentary. And honestly, it is very encouraging for you to note your disagreements, because it's difficult to disagree with someone that you admire so much and that you miss so much. And so it's just very encouraging that you have done that. The book is incredible. It's not perfect in my view, but it is incredible. It's not perfect in that, everybody agrees with everything. And I just wanted to share something about the natural hair thing. I can say for me, and I really do believe that this applies to most black women, that it is very difficult to wear our natural hair. It is so much easier to just perm it or get it pressed or something like that. What I have been doing for the longest time actually was just getting it braided, just my own hair, getting it braided. But I was depending on salons for this because I couldn't on my own just wear just like a normal hairstyle every day that you typically see, because I couldn't find the tangler to relax the curls enough to where, I could comb through it and just kind of manage it on my own. And I'm now going through that process, even though before I had let go of perms and all that a long time ago. But now I'm going through the process of just not even, depending on salons. And it is just a lot of work to wear our natural hair. Like, we don't look as
feminine if we cut our hair as short as men. So you guys can kind of manage your hair more, you know, by cutting it shorter, even though you have the same texture. But, you know, for us to have it long, it's just a whole lot of work. So I'm glad that, you know, this is being brought up. And that's why I made the statement. I'm almost done. That's why I made the statement earlier about us going natural probably has a lot to do with us buying the products, because I noticed in my own experience that it just takes more products for a situation like that, rather than just going to the salon and letting them braid it, or, you know, whatever the case may be. Last thing I want to say is that I just hope everyone has as great a weekend as possible under systemic white terrorism. I'll mute my line.
Try and stay as safe as we can. Any other folks, final comment, question they need to get in before we get ready to conclude?
Yes, I would like to comment on the employees, I guess, in Largo that were terminated because of their hairstyles, and a couple of other incidents she gave concerning, you know, practice, white people practicing racism against, you know, a cultural style of hair. But that very thing is still going on, because I know that within the last couple of years that a young man was suspended from school. He was elementary, and because of the way his hair looked. And another incident that crossed my mind. But, I was working with a fella that they was telling him that if he changed his hairstyle, that he would be put on in a permanent position. So it's still doing that. It may not be, you know, outright, out in the open, but that type of mistreatment is still going on today. I'll mute my line. Thanks, Doug.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery, for taking a glance. We will conclude there. We've done our full 3 hours. We will resume next Friday. Pam the Great, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Hopefully the iTunes problem will be corrected soon, so that all of the more recent archives will be available there. But in the meantime, the archives are current at Black Talk Radio Network. They are current at SoundCloud, where all of the book study sessions for Black Love as a Revolutionary Act are posted. We'll get the one for today there as well. But they're also at YouTube, courtesy of Mr. Fox. Great work across the pond in the UK getting the content uploaded. So the material is available, and I will post it. You can share. That's one way you can invest. Share the links to make sure people are not thinking, oh, Gus is slacking. Ivy was right. Got that yoga certification, and he bailed on us. He's not even doing the programs anymore. They're not uploaded to iTunes. That is not the case. We are rolling right along. There's just what I suspect, racist interference that is disrupting the upload of the archives at iTunes specifically, but they are available at the other locations. If you have questions, gripes, confusion about that, or anything else, UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. With that, we will call it a Friday evening. I hope folks will remain safe, constructive as we transition into autumn. The seasons generally hit me kind of hard, so I'm trying to smooth out the transition as best I can. In that spirit, sobriety would be best under conditions of systemic white terrorism. War is being waged against us. I think it would behoove us to be thinking clearly so that we can make phenomenal decisions, try to keep ourselves as safe as possible, in addition to being sober. Each and every time that we get in a vehicle, driver or passenger, let's be buckled up. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.